Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon and procedures and translates them to everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build public understanding of the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. And today, we're excited because we have with us a very special guest, Dr. Stephen A. Goldman. Dr. Goldman, who's been with us before, but let me remind you, he's a psychiatrist, an author, and a historian. And important to today's discussion, he also spent years at the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, as a medical product safety and risk management expert and regulator. We're going to talk today about the changes being made to some of our federal civil service positions by the Trump administration, making them more political in nature. We will discuss what that might mean to the operation of the federal government and to you at home. Before I jump in with the first question, Judge Gail, nice to talk with you. We've been on a bit of a hiatus during the holidays and both of us coming down with various bugs, you in Ohio and me in Massachusetts.
Yes, the bug has definitely sprouted wings and certainly felt it important to visit a few states. So it's good to have you back.
Well, thank you. I'm back, but my voice isn't quite. So I hope people can follow along anyway. Dr. Goldman, we've asked you to come on because of your expertise in several aspects of this topic. One, I think people need to know that currently, about come March 8th, just a couple of weeks from now, that nearly 50,000 federal workers who have previously been under the civil service laws will be changed to what's called at-will employment. In other words, they'll become political appointees that are dispensable. They can be fired at will. We have, as this country, spent hundreds of years speaking about the right of civil service and the necessity for civil service. Can you put this whole civil service concept in historical perspective for us?
Sure. Let me reiterate something which is at the root of all this, that federal employees, both in and outside the military, take similar oaths when you enter upon national service, in that both, quote, solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same. Those in the armed force additionally state, I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the officers appointed over me according to regulations and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. Neither of these oaths, and by the way, I took this oath on two separate occasions as a federal physician, neither oath is sworn or affirmed to an individual, administration, or political policy, just solely to the United States Constitution. This is critical to the understanding of the history of the professional apolitical civil service and the grave concern that many of us have about the changes that are being proposed and will go into effect under a new system that will impact at least what is estimated to be 50,000 of the jobs. And there was a good chance that the position I had at the FDA might have been one so affected, as I'll discuss.
So where did we start with civil service? I mean, this was a concept that came from when?
Actually, it started in China. It started much earlier than the United States. It's really blossomed under the great democracies. And there's a rich history of this. And let's be clear, when we talk about the apolitical civil service, we're talking about a merit-based system of selecting government officials and supervising their work. And as so often happens in history, the Pendleton Act, which was approved on January 6, 1883, which established that system in the United States, came about because of a tragic occurrence, the assassination of President James Garfield by the, quote, disgruntled job seeker. As a result of that, Congress passed the Pendleton Act in January of 1883, and it was designed specifically to get rid of the spoil system. And the spoil system derives from the phrase, not surprisingly, to the victor goes the spoils. So before you had literally this law establishing a federal government jobs being awarded on the basis of merit through competitive exams, and also making sure that those federal employees could not be used for political purposes, as we'll talk about, or accepting any political services contributions, and also establish a civil service commission to enforce the act, all because the spoil system meant that when a new administration came in, the government turned over. And the people were not being, for the most part, getting those positions based on merit. They were getting it based on what service they had done for the successful candidates.
Based on politics.
And in politics. So this law was critical, absolutely critical. And that started with that. And then all the things that came in after that, the collective bargaining agreements, the strengthening of the protection of federal workers. And let's be clear, this is not the first time the independence of federal workers has been challenged. The McCarthy era was a classic example of that, with the Lavender Scare, if people are not familiar with that, where people, gay or lesbian individuals, were literally being thrown out of their jobs simply because of their sexual orientation, when there were people being accused of being communists, although they were not under the McCarthy era. So this is not a new problem. However, what's happening now, President Trump attempted to do in his first administration, which was then, as I'll discuss, which was then reversed by President Biden, by the way, on his first day in office. That's how important he felt this was. Well, now it's back and it's been strengthened.
So, Stephen, what it sounds like, what you're describing is a system that at least appears to be designed for the competent, but does not, and correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't perfectly shield them, meaning that they are shielded from review or from even dismissal, but rather it's designed to ensure that the best people actually get and maintain the positions without being unfairly targeted for firing or dismissal. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. I mean, one of the things I do want to make clear that I and other people who are very concerned about this are in no way advocating for having protection of people who should not be continuing in their jobs under the civil service. That and I'll mention some studies that have been done by nonprofits who are apolitical themselves, looking at the civil service itself. I mean, one of the things that people have correctly criticized the federal civil service system is how hard it is to actually remove people who are not competent at their jobs because of the protections. That's always been acknowledged. Having said that, that is not the vast majority of federal employees. And you have a targeting and also an impression being made of the somehow the apolitical civil service is now a deep state, somehow an enemy of the American people, and which I signed on with the FDA. I had never heard the term deep state. And, you know, Judge Gale, the protection you have when you join the civil service is twofold. You only swear an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States. You are not part of an administration. For example, I worked at the FDA through two administrations. I was not part of those administrations. I was a civil servant. That protection means, you know, the famous expression, no fear, no favor. You are there because you're serving the American people and you're not a political appointee. You are not getting that position outside of what your expertise merits. You can give an opinion that is in relation to what your professional responsibilities and qualities are. There's also something else, which I really do want to emphasize. When you're a regulator, you are regulating under the laws passed by Congress. You are not passing laws yourself. Now, regulators, you know, regulatory agencies do promulgate regulations that have the force of law, but all regulatory bodies operate under the authority given to them by the elected representatives of Congress. They are not some organization that is not given the authority from elected officials. And I think that's an important point.
And Stephen, there seems to be another benefit that perhaps inures to the greater society or to the American people, which is the fact that when you have professionals that you've just identified that are not aligned with any particular administration, they are able to carry that expertise from one administration to another, and therefore the agency or the organization doesn't face kind of a draining, if you will, a brain drain every time there's a change in the White House, per se, or every time there's a change in the secretary.
Well, that was the spoil system. That's exactly what happened in the spoil system. And the beauty of a professional civil service, and again, it's not just the United States. You know, the British had a marvelous civil service that was basically running an entire empire, as you know. That, again, the institutional knowledge, people staying for their entire careers, and we're talking about decades in positions, you know, the anonymous civil servants who keep the country running in so many different ways. I mean, you know, Tom, you asked about how it affects, you know, the average American. Well, who's regulating the quality of the air and the water? Who's making sure that the aviation industry remains among the most safest in the world? Who is taking a look?
Pharmaceuticals.
I was just going to say, in terms of what is safe and effective, or safe and effective enough to go out on the market or be removed from the market. This is in the hands. Now, bear in mind that all of these agencies, again, scientifically based and otherwise, they are directed by members of the administration who are political appointees. Let me point out, however, that those political appointees, and including the President of the United States, take the same oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States as the military does. And the lodestar for us is the law, the Constitution. It is not a mandate from, again, any administration or any policy. And that's the way it's been. That's the way it's been set up since 1883.
Okay, from 1883. Now let's put this in perspective for mom and pop at home. In 2020, President Trump, during his first term, created this status, Schedule F, this scheduled policy and career change, basically to take civil service out and make it at-will employment for political appointees. He did that in 2020. Then Biden came in, and in 2021, threw that out. And
that
we were
true.
Back to the good old civil service the way it was. And then on January 20th, I believe, of last year, the inauguration day of 2025, President Trump issued an executive order reinstating this at-will policy. And it's taken the Office of Personnel Management until February of this year to issue their final rule titled Improving Performance, Accountability, and Responsiveness in the Civil Service, which in fact is a misnomer because it does the opposite. So all of these things going back and forth, the poor federal employees have to feel like they're on the end of a string of a yo-yo.
October 21st, 2020 was the creation of the new Schedule F, which could not be implemented because Joe Biden was reelected. He thought this was so important an issue that on January 22nd, 2021, after coming into office, he ordered the following, quote, Section 1 policy, career civil servants are the backbone of the federal workforce, providing the expertise and experience necessary for the critical functioning of the federal government. It is the policy of the United States to protect, empower, and rebuild the career federal workforce. It is also the policy of the United States to encourage union organizing and collective bargaining. The federal government should serve as a model employer. So not only did President Biden essentially negate the attempt to create Schedule F, they also implemented other aspects to enable collective bargaining rights. And by the way, this had been a campaign promise of President Biden to do this and to take steps to ensure and empower federal employees the way it had been done before. The second thing that they did was the fact that not knowing what was going to happen in the next administration, in April of 2024, the Office of Personnel Management issued a new rule that would hopefully continue the merit-based system by protecting and to prevent, hopefully, any future attempts to revive Schedule F. But the problem with the OPM rule is it's a rule. It is not a law. Therefore, the standing that it could have as a guardrail, well, now we know what power it has or does not have, because now we now have the return of Schedule F.
Yeah, this month, effective March 8th.
That is correct. And this is also after what we have already seen about what was promulgated in May of 2025 last year, the Merit Hiring Plan, which is the preceding of what was just announced.
All of these misnomers that they call something exactly the opposite of what it is.
And again, that was the title. And one of the things involved in that, which again was, as they claimed to be reforming the job application process, suddenly for each job application graded above GS-5, which GS goes up to 15, asking for four short free response essay questions for all federal job vacancy announcements, including how would you help advance the president's executive orders and policy priorities in this role? Identify one or two relevant executive orders or policy initiatives that are significant to you and explain how you would help implement them if hired. That is brand new. There is nothing previously of that I'm aware of, or anyone seems to be aware of anyone being asked as part of the process to join the apolitical civil service to explain how a president's executive orders would be carried out.
Gail?
And I'm just...
Yeah, I know you're sitting there in awe. I can tell by your silence. You're
it's
sitting there
so...
with your mouth open in awe.
Wildly inappropriate, because as to Stephen's point at the opening, which is when government employees and members of the military are required to take an oath, they don't take an oath to an individual. They take an oath to the Constitution and to essentially query a would-be government employee. First of all, I'm willing to bet donuts to dollars that most would-be government employees could not even name two, presidential executive orders. They probably couldn't. And to ask them such a question as a condition of employment, even knowing that notwithstanding the answer, at least from what I'm understanding, Stephen, what you're saying, notwithstanding the answer, even if the answer is correct, perfect, and pristine, or maybe perfectly written by AI these days, who knows? If they act in contravention to that, their employment is at will, and they could still face summary firing.
Well, this is an idea in evolution, implementation in evolution. It is the ramifications are protean. I mean, you can see where this could lead. And we've seen historically where this can lead.
I would go as far as to say we've seen at least, you know, and I don't think that legacy media has been really, I don't think they've been at the top of their game in addressing.
They've been lousy at covering this. Lousy.
So much for diplomacy. I do think that more could be done to bring this to the fore. But I would say that there's at least one instance that I think we've been, that we've really been faced forward on. And that's Lisa Cook over at the Federal Reserve. And I think in part because her situation made it to the Supreme Court, which, by the way, I don't know that I have seen an administration rush to the United States Supreme Court so frequently and be provided an audience so often, so frequently on so many things, and probably deservedly so because so much of this is out of the norm. But this one in particular is actually pretty interesting given all of the machinations around it and the traditional role of the Federal Reserve being an independent body the way that it is, and kind of the idea that John Sauer, the attorney for the government, essentially says, you know what, the president can fire a Fed governor just because I guess he woke up, he had a bad day, and his shirt wasn't starched tough enough. I don't know.
If I'm correct, Dr. Goldman, the Lisa Cook thing is important for precedent, but it's not exactly the same as to the rest of the federal workers. Is that correct?
I really didn't want to jump back to that because
it's important, though.
Yeah, it is important. And I do want to jump back to what, you know, we were saying before. And obviously, Judge Gale, there are parallels there.
And I think it'll be precedent setting. And notwithstanding the fact that it is not a perfect mirror image of the reality of every other federal worker who was once covered by civil service protections, I do believe that depending upon how the U.S. Supreme Court rules, that this could be used as a precedent to argue either for or against future actions similar as it relates to previously protected employees.
Well, let me give you the results of a study that was done by the Partnership for Public Service, which is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization. And they did a study that they have on their website looking at at-will employment in state governments to take a look what implications they might have if the federal civil service becomes at will. Three key findings emerged from our research. There is no evidence that adoption of at-will employment improves employee or agency performance. At-will employment creates risk of firings for political reasons and for issues unrelated to performance, while serving as a disincentive for employees to report wrongdoing, voice objections, or express differing opinions from political leadership. Third, at-will employment may shrink the talent pool for federal agencies and increase employee turnover rates, creating challenges for agencies to achieve their missions and effectively serve the public. Taken together, the evidence suggests that a move to at-will employment could risk politicization of the federal workforce while not addressing the root causes of the federal government's broken personnel management system. To help ensure effective service delivery to the American people, alternative evidence-based reforms are needed to improve employee performance and hold both career and political leaders accountable. I think this is a terrific report and very significant. This was posted, it's on their website, and they have this, and again, in relation to other things they've posted on what's now happening or potentially happening with what used to be called Schedule F.
Sounds like the exact opposite of what this Schedule F was allegedly supposed to achieve.
Well, and again, that's a very good point because, and again, I know it's anecdotal, but I can tell you my experience in being in a position, I said, which may be reclassified under this new system. I can't recall a time at the FDA or the VA or another place I've been. No one asked any of us who we had voted for. I didn't know the political views of most of the people I work with. They were absolutely irrelevant because we're in the apolitical civil service. And the things that both of you asked before, I do want to reiterate this. Joining a federal agency under the existing laws and protections was so empowering and liberating at a scientific, medically based organization. Where, by the way, you could have disagreements among people in terms of interpretation and how, but when you made a decision, there was not the perception that you were trying to stymie an administration when you made a decision or gave a judgment, that you were trying to serve the American people to the best of your ability, surrounded by other amazing people at the agencies. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times that we would all get together, try and make a decision. We came to a consensus, and I can't even think of a time where we were ever accused of trying to obstruct what the administration was trying to do or implying that we had been co-opted or that we were simply there to be obstructive. We thought the opposite. And the other aspect that we tried so hard to do at the FDA was not be anonymous. One of my jobs at MedWatch, as the MedWatch medical director, was to go out and talk to the public. I mean, we had an open phone line. We were on the phone with the American people every day to make it clear that there were people behind as part of the bureaucracy. And we were very proud of that. And we were certainly not the only organization doing that. And the tone of these things, and I guess, Judge Gale, I guess that's what you're referring to, the tone of what is said as justification for trying to make these changes is so negative. And by the way, is consistent with Project 2025, which discussed the plan for this, which made this clear that the civil service was going to be something that was going to be addressed.
Let me jump in here because I did some research in preparing for today's discussion, and I found I was looking for perspectives of proponents of this change. And I wrote this down. I wish it was a quote from somebody. I wish I knew who it was. I failed to write that down, but it's basically good for our argument here. This quote said for a proponent, proponents argue it increases flexibility and accountability by allowing agencies to quickly remove employees who are underperforming or subverting presidential directives. What's your response to that?
This sets up, I mean, we didn't have, that I was aware of, an adversarial relationship with the administration. I mean, we had commissioners who were, you know, nominated and, approved by Congress. And so there was clearly a representative from the administration who was running the FDA. We didn't have an adversarial relationship. We thought, you know, agencies, other governmental entities, including Department of Justice, have mission statements. And if you're not there and accepting what that mission statement is, then why are you there in the first place? There's other places to work besides the government. And we, the people, and people came from so many different backgrounds from, you know, military and other backgrounds coming into work. And but the thing that I thought was the baseline of all that was a desire to serve the American people to the best of our ability. You know, executive orders aren't the law.
Right.
Agreed.
We are in a 100% agreement on that.
There's a reason why it's called No Fear, No Favor. There's a reason why the Department of Justice is supposed to stand for justice. There's a reason why, and again, you're the attorneys. My understanding of federal prosecutors is that traditionally, the line prosecutors are the ones who decide whether a case has merit to be brought. Because they are apolitical. They're not practicing politics as a member of the DOJ, just like we were not administering politics as apolitical federal employees at the FDA or NIH or the CDC or the EPA or other places. That's not why you have a merit-based federal workforce. That is the beauty of this. Yes, there are things that need to be changed about federal workers who should not be in the positions they're in or are not functioning. But to imply that this is the vast majority of federal workers, where's the evidence for that?
Indeed. And again, when you have workers in any environment that are underperforming or have demonstrated dereliction of duty or are not capable of performing their responsibilities, there are processes in place.
Yes.
That not only ensure that either their performance improves or that they are properly separated.
Correct.
And being a civil servant does not protect you from that process.
Nor should it.
But it also should not be one that is, that essentially, yeah, I don't know if you all have ever heard of like the plum book or the plum manual. We shouldn't use these positions now to essentially substitute them for the plum book, because now every position essentially becomes a plum position because it's at the will of the current administration. And that is to the detriment of the American people.
I mean, I could make it, and that's a great point. Congress passed the laws under which governmental organizations operate. And there were many times that one of the things that I would do when I was speaking to physicians, nurses, other healthcare professionals, and the general public about a new law that had gone into effect, it was my remit, because again, as I mentioned before, and I was very proud of this, I spoke for the agency. I would tell them what the legislation said. I wasn't rendering an opinion on the legislation. I was explaining what the legislation said and the ramifications that might be for the work that the FDA was doing, which is perfectly within the remit of what you are asked to do. Under this new system, if this is changed to the extent that it looks like it's going to be, the pressure that would be put on apolitical civil servants to potentially be removed for any perception of obstruction of an administration objective, how I can't see how this can possibly be a benefit to the American people.
Well, let me jump in here with the argument that, you know, the Trump administration has been criticized by many, and I think rightfully so, as being anti-science, anti-data, anti-fact-based decision-making, whether it's on the environment or medical issues, vaccinations, or whatever. It seems now that these poor civil servants who are in positions of regulating are caught in a catch-22. You know, it's not going to work for them. They're either going to be fired or they're going to bow to the administration, which advances a non-scientific base decision-making.
Well, look at the turnover that we see in the worker bee level and in the leadership level Take a look what's happened with the vaccine committees, where you now have health professional organizations putting out their own recommendations. We're seeing things that are frankly unprecedented. I mean, one of the things that me and my colleagues were so proud of at the FDA were when they would do surveys about what agencies were trusted. And this was in the 90s. The FDA was always among the agency that was voted among the most trusted. And I think one of the major reasons for that was you had an apolitical civil service whose one mission was protecting the public health of the United States.
Yeah, if the FDA said it, it was golden.
Well, based on what we knew, I mean, you know, we changed labeling.
The best decision at the moment. It was a golden decision.
Right. And believe me, we agonized over those decisions, but we also had the capability with, again, the amazing people I work with to make changes. Things did come off the market when we had more information, or changes were made in how things were administered. And let me also point out that we did our work out in the open. Advisory committees, meetings that we had, you know, when something went into the Federal Register before an advisory committee, the documents would be available to anyone who wanted to read them. How much more open can you get than that? And I reveled in the concept of that kind of openness.
And I think something else that was a comfort to the public, particularly when you talk about the FDA, is the fact that without regard to whomever was the head of the FDA or whoever sat in the White House, what you knew was that these decisions were coming from some of the same brilliant brains, administration over administration. So you weren't getting a different response just because someone else was warming a seat.
Experts, not politicians.
Exactly. And that there was really, you know, there really was a lot of respect for the experts, for the people who had been kind of living and breathing this. My concern now is not just for that and the fact that now there's this huge, huge trust erosion for what comes out of a lot of our federal agencies, not the least of which when it comes to our health. Also, the fact that as we look to remain a huge player on the world stage, part of the way that we're able to do that, and I would hope you'd agree, part of the way that we're able to do that is because we're able to attract some of the best and brightest from around the world. And by pivoting in this direction, I think what we essentially do is we tell the best and brightest to go look someplace else because they've got to figure out how to make their scientific decisions or their fact-based decisions or their statistically sound decisions align with whatever color the moon is according to whomever the seat warmer is. And I think that is a huge detriment to us as a nation. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, you also have other factors. Social media is a huge factor.
Can you expound more on that?
Yeah, how so?
How do you know what's accurate and what's not accurate? How do you know what someone claims is actually based on fact? Where are you when there is such a distrust at this point, which again, Gail, I presume that's what you were alluding to, as to, I mean, there's a lot of anti-expertise feeling out there that, I mean, I've heard it advocate to my face in some discussions.
If I could say, that may be true, but do you think some of it is because we've put some non-experts in some really high-profile leadership roles and given them huge microphones? I mean, all but provided them with megaphones to swallow so that they can pontificate in areas that they have no training?
The answer is yes. Having said that, not every head of Health and Human Services had any scientific training. There have been many who have not. But I think one of the things that I'm sensing, and I can't tell you how it hurts, is, and again, I'm going by my experience and certainly the experience of others with all the different agencies, is when the administration's changed and they bring in new leadership, I never perceived a belief that the people of the professional civil service who carry on the work weren't worthy of trust by the members of the incoming administration, whether it was Republican or Democrat, that people believed in this system, which had worked since 1883 with other protections, that it was designed to ensure that the new administration coming in with their own ideas didn't have to worry that you didn't have people with expertise in their particular areas to carry on the work. I'm not hearing that now, are you?
No, not at all.
No, we're hearing the opposite in a way I've never heard before. Have you?
Don't believe your eyes, believe what we tell you.
And we know historically where this can lead. It's not just in certain areas of the government where this can lead. It's all of a piece in some ways, a tone of, I don't know if I want to use the term anti-intellectual because I don't want to run into, well, who's an intellectual and who isn't.
It's anti-fact based.
Fact or competency. Yeah, and you know, Gail, like you pointed out, I'm not mistaken, aren't some indictments being thrown out because they've been drafted so poorly?
Well, and just the lack of competence and skill set for those making presentations, because again, when your effort is to purge, I think lose sight of the fact that there's a lot of institutional knowledge that walks out of the door, and there's great value in that institutional knowledge.
Further from that, the knowledge that's not going to be walking in the door. Because again, those are the three things they talked about with this report. What happens down the line? I mean, FDA always had a feeder system from the schools of pharmacy, as an example.
Which is what my point was too, is attracting the best and brightest, right? Trying to create that feeder system. And I think you stymie it. You actually choke it off.
It's also an ethos. You know, we're products of our time. And for those of us from the 60s and 70s, and hopefully, Tom, you'll second this. We watched a war. We watched corruption. We found out a government was capable of lying to us about a war that cost the lives of 58,000 American soldiers, sailors, and Marines. Those of us who came of age during that time went into public service because we felt that we could do it differently.
Yeah, we did. We definitely felt that it could be different and better.
And better. And I think in many ways it was. There were things that came into place. And I'm sure, Gail, I'm sure for you the same way. People go into public service. You're not going to make the kind of money you can make in other places, for the most part. Yes, up until now, the jobs have felt to be secure. But you still have to get up and go to work. And in these organizations we're talking about, it doesn't take long for some of the people, the real pros, to know someone doesn't belong there. I mean, take a look at the expertise we're talking about, whether it's, you know, NIH or EPA or the FAA. I mean, these are top pros or NOAA. I mean, these are the best of the best and the brightest, and they've been acknowledged that way. And many of us represented the United States, you know, in international meetings. And many people felt that we were at least gold standard with other organizations. You can't come into that situation without the expertise, because it becomes glaringly obvious when you're dealing with the other pros in the fields. And I think that's an aspect here we're talking about. And the American people will see the result of this in so many different ways that aren't, you know, blatantly obvious, you know, every night at the dinner table, because there are so many federal workers who are involved in work that is in some ways invisible to people, but it goes on every day. I think we're all saying what is becoming evident is that this is a point of inflection. And where it's going to lead is certainly a concern.
We've got about 10 minutes left. And Gail, I wanted to jump in on some legal stuff. And we can tie this back to Steve. But there are some cases been pending for about a year. The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, the American Federation of Government Employees, and others, Treasury Union, have filed lawsuits that are bubbling up to the courts. There's a hearing on February 27th of this year, just in a week or so, scheduled to determine whether there should be a preliminary injunction barring the implementation of what we have been talking about. All of that's going on while we have this Trump versus Cook case at the U.S. Supreme Court that's already been argued, but no decision probably won't come out till June, I would imagine. Talk about where we stand legally here.
I think we are just really in a bit of a holding pattern. Would you agree?
Well, I think these lower court injunctions, I think we all agree, even Dr. Goldman, that the lower courts have been doing the yeoman work here on trying to sort out these cases. But I think we are in a holding pattern till we see how the Supremes come out on the Cook case. Even though it's not exactly on point, it certainly is precedential.
That was my point earlier, is that there's going to be a lot of eyes on the Cook case because, you know, we have, you know, different types of precedent. And this, I think, will be argued as persuasive, meaning used to persuade courts as opposed to essentially command them to follow it, where there's no perfect overlay with other facts that may appear to be somewhat similar but are not perfectly aligned. And I think that's exactly why we're kind of waiting. We're in, what, February now? Usually the Supreme Court starts releasing
end of June. They'll start issuing more opinions. Closing or oral arguments stop generally in April, and then it's really a machine to get all the opinions out.
Yes. So it'll be somewhere between April and late June. There will be a flurry of writing, and then we'll wait to hear what the decision is. But I was actually pretty surprised that the Supreme Court did not permit the administration to proceed with removing Ms. Cook, even while this matter's pending. And that's just based on how we've seen them act and respond to this administration since it became reconstituted in January of last year.
Yeah.
It's pretty shocking, but it was also refreshing. So even though, and I agree with you, even though we've seen the trial courts do a lot of the heavy lifting, I think you'd agree, Judge Tom, that for all the heavy lifting and for a lot of the heavy lifting the trial courts have done, we've seen some of the appellate courts do a lot of the rolling back. So
yeah,
it's
right.
Back to
absolutely.
That yo-yo of the trial court speaks, the appellate court says not so fast, and you wait and wait and wait to see if the Supreme Court will ever even grant certiorari to take the case up to make a final decision, which is what's leaving a lot of workers in limbo. I think, Dr. Goldman, you mentioned about 50,000 federal employees being impacted by this decision, which is set to go into effect in a few short weeks. And although to some folks it may not represent much, but it does represent a percentage of the entire federal workforce. And that matters. I want to say it's around, what, 1 or 2% of the entire federal workforce, which may not mean much unless you're part of that 50,000 or your household's impacted by that.
It goes beyond that, because these are being designated at policy-making positions.
Yeah, talk about that, Steve. What's that mean?
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, technically, the job I had at FDA technically was not a policy position per se, although I did a lot of work with people doing policy, and they had me reviewing legislation and other things. My guess is the position I eventually evolved to would probably be one. But those are, you know, agencies do promulgate policies. That is in their remit, because you're interpreting legislation, you're interpreting regulation. So, Judge Gale, this is very important. I mean, 50,000 are some of the most major decision makers within the organizations in the civil service. And you're talking about June on a decision. Well, what happens in the meantime? What happens to this rule being implemented? And by the way, there is a lawsuit that's going to be filed. The American Federation of Government Employees, the AFGE, represents 820,000 federal and DC government workers. Of course, and they put out an announcement on February 9th that they'll be leading a coalition of unions, other parties, in filing a lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's latest effort to undermine the civil service. That was their quote.
Well, they're the ones who are the plaintiffs in the preliminary injunction case on February 27th.
Right, that's correct. So what is the relation between that and the Cook case before the Supreme Court?
Well, I think the Supreme Court is trying to work in isolation. They're not looking down at the lower courts on the rest of this. Would you agree, Gail?
At least that's what they'll tell us. And I think that's often been the case, is that the U.S. Supreme Court doesn't really allow itself to become distracted by what is or what may happen in the lower courts, because they certainly have enough work of their own, and they aren't required to respond to everything that happens in a lower court. Again, unlike the appellate courts, they can pick and choose. They can literally handpick their docket, and they don't have to respond. They don't have to necessarily care. And so their focus doesn't have to be there.
Where does this leave federal employees?
Well, I think it leaves federal employees in the lurch, and leaves the country
in the lurch.
really in the lurch, because it's just another step towards, as I said, don't believe what your eyes or your mind tell you. Believe what we tell you.
Your lying eyes.
Yeah, that's right. Steve, we only got a couple more minutes, and I always want to give you the last word. You're the expert. Thank you for your patience with us in discussing this. You know, mom and pop at home can't do a whole lot. Maybe talk to their congressman, but that doesn't usually do much good. But, you know, are you hopeful that this will work out, or are you pessimistic?
To be honest, pessimistic. There is a tone to this. And, you know, we haven't even talked about the implications of the views on the power of the executive.
Right.
Which another is time. Really, right. Another time we'll have to. I don't know if there's enough information being given to Americans overall about how important this is to the running of the government. And, you know, we're trying to do that today. You know, there are things that people ask me about, and there are things I try and do. I try and have a voice. You try and be fair in your, which I think we've tried to be today, but when you've been in the system and you've seen it work, and you think about all the things that this system of civil service has accomplished for the United States, and to see it threatened as it's been doing, it is a very hard thing to watch. And that's not simply as a former Fed, that's as an American citizen who believes in this system. And it's not a belief that's not based in reality.
Well, thank you as always, Dr. Goldman, Steve, for coming and talking with us and sharing your views with our audience. I think this has been underreported, and hopefully we're doing our part to bring some clarity to the issues. Judge Gail, how they find us?
You can always check us out, Next Witness Please, anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. That includes one of our steadfast supporters, NPR, National Public Radio. But you can also find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, or as I said, anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. We genuinely believe that you don't trust what you don't understand. And as evidenced by Dr. Goldman joining us, we certainly hope that you understand these issues more and that you will trust us as a result of that. So please check us out. Next Witness Please. We're back in action and looking forward to continue connecting with you.
And if you have questions or comments about our podcast, you can always email them directly to me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, at ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you'd like for us to discuss or cover in the future, please shoot us an email on that as well. Next Witness Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron's our co-producer and audio engineer. And Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks.